Welcome to New Books in Politics. I'm Jeff Bloodworth, your host. In 1945, in our issue of the Partisan Review, Hannah Arendt declared that the problem of evil would be the fundamental question of post-war intellectual life in Europe. Now, from my perspective, I think Arendt was incorrect in that, in the short term, intellectuals and academics began to question the very notion of the idea of quote-unquote evil. And it's only recently, in the 1990s and 2000s, that intellectuals and academics have once again begun to turn their attention in a serious way to thinking about evil as a concept to study in and of itself. In that spirit, this week I've interviewed Alan Wolfe and to talk about his excellent new book, Political Evil, What It Is and How to Combat It. Now, Professor Wolfe is one of America's leading public intellectuals. He has written widely on divergent issues that are of public interest. And this was a really fun conversation about what I believe is a really readable, accessible, and really outstanding and important book. So listen to the interview, buy the book, and go read it. Thanks.
Hello?
Alan Wolfe.
Yeah,
welcome to New Books in Politics.
Thank you.
Yeah,
pleasure to be with you.
Great to have you on. First, I really enjoyed your book, Political Evil, What It Is and How to Combat It. And I have to make a small admission. Like most good things in my life, I kind of bumbled into this book by accident. When I first contacted you, I was interested in interviewing you about your book on liberalism, and then, but I'm really happy that this was the book, you know, that we're going to be talking about, because I really thought it was really something.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, first, why don't you just tell the listeners, give us a brief kind of, you know, biography, personal and educational.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm a political scientist, academic political scientist, but I've always tried to write for larger audiences, and I write books, which in some departments of political science in the United States would kind of count against you if you were coming up for tenure, but I started early, I love doing it, and I just don't seem to be able to stop. Someday maybe I'll run out of things to write about, but I don't know, it hasn't happened yet. So Political Evil is a book that was essentially motivated by the fact that I was one of the many people in the 1960s who protested the war in Vietnam and thought that war and militarism were bad things. I thought the idea that Vietnam represented a kind of domino and that communism would take over the world unless we took a firm stand there was bogus. I still believe most of that, but I did, you know, as I got older, develop more of a respect for the idea that sometimes it is necessary for the United States to deploy its military forces, mm-hmm. and that when we're dealing with situations of truly awful things, such as genocide and ethnic cleansing, the grounds for military intervention on humanitarian grounds become a lot stronger. I write a lot for the magazine The New Republic, and a number of their writers are what I would call humanitarian interventionists.
Yeah.
In fact, almost every time there's a case of something awful or terrible coming taking place somewhere abroad, they want to intervene. And I couldn't go along with them. And so while I was sympathetic to the idea that we ought to use our military when necessary, I wasn't sure that it's necessary all the time. And then the Bush administration came along, and what it was saying about Islam and the threat to the United States was so totally and obviously untrue, mm-hmm. right from the start, at least as I understood it and other people like me, that I really began to see what you could call evil inflation. Mm-hmm. Just using the word evil over and over and over again in what I think became a very self-defeating way. So that's why I wrote my book. My book argues on the one hand that evil exists, there is such a thing, that political evil, which is the use of a state or a movement and all the weapons and taxation revenue that implies is particularly horrific.
Mm-hmm.
There certainly are cases where we ought to intervene to stop it. But we need to be very, very careful when we do, or else we may wind up adding to the evil in the world rather than subtracting from it. That's the thesis of the book, and that's how I came to write it.
Well, I mean, just from a selfish perspective, these are some of the very issues I've been struggling with over the last 10 years. I mean, I'm a New Republic subscriber.
Mm-hmm.
I consider myself a humanitarian interventionist. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think the war in Iraq and, you know, the liberal, at least it seemed to me a lot of big name liberal hawks and the New Republic backing that war has really, you know, rightfully caused a lot of us to kind of go back to our corners and rethink our foreign policies. So I was reading this and I was like, oh man, this is, you know, you've saved me quite a bit of trouble. You've done your thinking for me or you've organized it. But
well, you'll certainly do your thinking for you, but I'm glad to hear that. I mean, it's always good to know that, you know, one's not completely alone in all of this. And the New Republic, you know, a magazine, I'm on the contributing editor, although I haven't been writing at all for them for the last year and a half. And if you want, we can talk about that.
But
I was greatly honored to be asked to be a contributing editor. The New Republic really shaped my outlook on the world.
Yeah.
I think the literary editor who I work with for years, Leon Musatir, is a truly brilliant man. But I disagree with the direction that he's pursued, mm-hmm. at least with respect to many of the authors that write there. And yeah, it was close to home for me. And some of the people that I criticize, one example would be Paul Berman, who writes a lot about Islam and so on. I know these people, you know, I wouldn't say we're friends, but I've known them.
Yeah.
And I just simply disagree. Intellectual debate is about disagreement. So I wrote the book.
Yeah, no, it has the feel of, the New York intellectuals of the 50s and 60s in this book.
Thanks.
And just to be curious, because I was surprised that you were a political scientist, because as you do say, I mean, you write books and you write so lucidly. Who do you, like, amongst a political scientist, or who maybe not even in your field, who do you consider the sorts of people that you write in the tradition of?
Well, in the tradition of means people that came before me.
Yeah.
And there certainly were a lot of them. I mean, I think that someone who recently died and is known as a very, very strong-willed conservative was James Q. Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
While I don't mean to compare myself to him, I think he was a genius and wrote in many, many different areas and was a truly remarkable man. I would say that, you know, my less abilities, I would model myself after him. He certainly wrote books, very influential books, on a wide variety of subjects. In fact, he writes on almost exactly the same subjects that I do. So, you know, that would be one example. In sociology, you know, which I also dabble in, people like Daniel Bell, mm-hmm. and David Rees. I mean, when I started out in the business, I thought that these were the most eminent names.
Yeah.
Only later did I learn that even some of them were somewhat marginalized in their own universities.
Yeah, it's a shame. I mean, I tell my students sometimes, you know, I dare them if they can name one famous sociologist.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, well, they don't even know who William Julius Wilson is.
But, yeah.
You know, what? Because I was assuming you were a sociologist, actually.
Well, I've taught in both, but my PhD, although that was a half a century ago, is in political science, and you know, that's where I am now.
Yeah.
I teach now at Boston College, and one of the things I learned, I certainly never learned it in graduate school, but I learned it in the course of my life, is that a number of faith-based institutions, in my case Catholic, are much more receptive and much more responsible to the more intellectual as opposed to the more academic side of things. And I've been very, very welcome at Boston College, and I love the place. I love my colleagues. And we have, you know, we sort of think of ourselves as doing political science the old-fashioned way.
Yeah.
Before all this methodological fetishism became so dominant.
Yeah, back when history and political science were so much more sister fields. Mm-hmm. I'm a historian. Yeah. Back to your book. Just kind of walk our listeners through your argument. And I mean, to me, this is the sort of book that you really need to read two or three times, because there's just so much in it. But I mean, first, you do a nice job of defining, political evil. And you just kind of talk to us a little bit about what political evil is.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, evil, the term evil, if you just use it without an adjective, one of the things I say in the book, it's not original with me. It was the philosopher Peter Singer who first noticed this, that when George W. Bush used the term evil, he used it as a noun. I teach at a Catholic university, as I said, and in some of my courses, I teach St. Augustine, who I've become completely fascinated with.
Yeah.
And Augustine, in a sense, really warned against thinking about evil as a noun. Hmm. That is, as an essence.
Yeah.
As a thing in itself.
Yeah.
He talked about how we have a capacity for evil or a will to do evil, but if evil was a thing in itself, then you couldn't explain why it was there, because if you believe in God, as he did, and if you believe God is all-powerful and all-good, then why would he have put evil in the world? So I'm very sympathetic to that. So I didn't want to talk about evil unless it was modified by something else.
Yeah.
And so I'm talking about political evil, which is not... and the reason why is because I don't know, and I could never answer a question about, is Osama bin Laden evil?
Yeah.
Or anyone else. I mean, I certainly think he is, but I couldn't prove it. I don't know him. I can't look at inside his heart.
Uh-huh.
But are the acts that terrorists do politically evil? Yes, absolutely. That you don't need to look into someone's heart to talk about that, because political evil is the use of intentionally cruel and vicious means to achieve a strategic and realizable objective. That's how I define it in the book. And you can just look at the objective. You should respond, I say in the book, to the politics and not respond to the evil. But we're inclined, especially someone like President Bush, to respond to the evil, and even to say that if they're that evil, they can't be political at all.
Yeah, what I find is interesting, and it's the sort of thing I've been thinking a lot about, it seems to me, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that this book is written, to a particular piece or part of the American or Western left, and giving us a kind of a vocabulary of how to think about and confront the world, after the Cold War and after George Bush,
mm-hmm.
And so, you're talking, it seems to me that, you talk about your second and third thoughts on U.S. foreign policy, and that you see yourself, and I think this book is kind of a way to update liberal anti-communism for the 21st century. Is that, am I on to anything at all?
No, I think that I would accept that.
Yeah.
The book got a very nice review in the New York Times from Jonathan Rauch, who's a libertarian.
Hmm.
Not a right-wing libertarian.
Yeah.
And more conservative than I am, certainly. But that's what he said, more or less, that this book is an attempt to offer a framework for the left to think about serious problems in a way that avoids isolationism and excessive interventionism. I wouldn't claim any particular originality here.
Mm-hmm.
In the course of the book, I discovered I always knew I had an appreciation for a thinker like Reinhold Niebuhr,
yeah.
But in doing the book, that really became stronger.
Yeah.
In doing the book, I had more respect and developed more respect for George F. Kennan, who mm-hmm. I used to think of as, aloof and anti-democratic and very elitist. But I began to see some of his points. And so there is a tradition of realism.
Mm-hmm.
It can, in some quarters, lead to basically turning your back on morality and ethics completely, and I wouldn't go there. But I certainly think the left needs to be realistic in what it can achieve. And the great danger is a kind of missionary Manichaeanism,
yeah.
Of dividing the world up into good and evil and always assuming that we're on one side.
Yeah, I mean, and again, this is, again, what I liked about this book. I mean, you claim that, despite the title, that this is an optimistic book. Could you talk about why the optimism? And I think it is, maybe it's kind of a Niebuhrian optimism.
But yeah, could you explain that? Optimism. Well, you're right. It's a tempered optimism. I mean, because I think that, you know, when you fall to into Manichaean language. By the way, for people who might listen to this, I have a long thing in the book that I'm particularly proud of, where I point out that it is true, as many people used to say, that George W. Bush was influenced by his religious background when he talked about good and evil in black and white terms. But it wasn't a Christian way of thinking. It was a way of thinking associated with the Persian prophet Mani, after whom the word Manichaean comes from, which was profoundly anti-Christian in its basic outlook on the world. Once you fall into that Manichaean trap, which I'm afraid some of the leaders of Israel are doing at the moment, where you view your enemies as the essence of evil. You can't negotiate with them. You can never engage them politically because they're the essence of evil. Well, you can never win because you can never really eradicate evil from the world. Now, maybe the point is you don't want to win. Maybe you want to engage in endless struggle. There's now an all but forgotten 1950s-ish figure named James Burnham, who is associated with the National Review. Mm-hmm. And that's really how he looked at the world. It was just an endless struggle. This grew out of the fact that some of the real anti-communists at an earlier era were once on the left, they were once Trotskyites. And they borrowed from Trotsky this idea of a permanent revolution, endless, ongoing. It'll never end. Well, compared to that, if we can just forget about eliminating evil completely, but stop a genocide, hopefully before it happens, but even after, well, that's optimistic. You know, that's saying we can respond to local conditions at specific times, as opposed to this much more religiously inspired idea of totally transforming the world.
Yeah. So if you could talk about the different forms of political evil that you write about.
Well, I write about terrorism and ethnic cleansing and genocide. I also talk about what I call counter-evil, the use of evil to fight evil. As it happens, night before last, I was asked to introduce Jane Mayer of the New Yorker at an event at Boston College, and her book, The Dark Side, is the single best book ever written about the Bush administration's reliance on evil means torture and extraordinary rendition and the fight against evil. So those are the general kinds of evil I'm talking about.
You do a nice job of kind of discussing the differences, you know, between ethnic cleansing and then talking about genocide. This is the phrase that sticks in my head. What happens in Munich stays in Munich, where you sort of try to throw into the trash can or the dustbin of history once and for all, you know, Nazi analogies and Munich analogies. Yeah. If you could just talk about that.
Well, you know, I do think that there are horribly, awfully, dreadfully evil leaders that sometimes come about and grasp the state and use it for the most horrific of means. And when that happens, we have to do something about it. So I'm not opposed at all to the idea that Hitler and Stalin were enemies of that nature, nor am I opposed to the idea that the concept that was developed to explain them, the concept of totalitarianism, was a bad concept. I think in many ways we need a term, a dramatic term, to capture how fully evil they were, and totalitarianism is a pretty good one.
Yeah.
So I want to, in a sense, call attention to the truly awful people by saying, let's not overuse a word like totalitarianism. Let's not overuse a word like fascism or Stalinism, and especially let's not see every tin-horn dictator or horrible person that comes down the pike as Hitler reincarnate.
Yeah.
Now, I think that the crucial example of all of that was a man who I have no doubt, you know, although, again, I said earlier to my, I can't look into someone's heart, you know, but if I could, I would be pretty sure that a guy like Slobodan Milosevic, the leader of Serbia, was evil in that sense.
Yeah.
But to compare him to Hitler is nonsense. I mean, he only wanted Serbia for the Serbians.
Yeah.
He didn't want to invade Czechoslovakia, invade Poland. He didn't want to create a greater Serbia that would constitute all of first Eastern Europe and then all of Europe and then maybe all of the world. I mean, but, you know, there's one person in America. He's now very old, but he was my favorite newspaper columnist, op-ed columnist ever, probably, and that's Anthony Lewis of the New York Times.
Yeah.
He lives in Boston. I know him well. His wife was the Chief Justice of the Massachusetts Supreme Court who made gay marriage legal in our Commonwealth. And he said that Slobodan Milosevic was another Hitler. Well, you know, Tony, as much as I really admire you greatly, you were wrong about that.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't. Of course, now, you know, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who doesn't even have full power within Iran, is the next Hitler, or Saddam Hussein was the next Hitler. I mean, there itself is an interesting example, because if you want to fight evil people, and Saddam Hussein was pretty evil, and I have no doubt that Ahmadinejad is not the nicest character in the world. You know, you want to play those two guys off against each other. Iran and Iraq have been historic enemies.
Mm-hmm.
And yet by calling them both reincarnations of Hitler, we drew them together.
Yeah.
Honest, one of the greatest blunders of 20th century American foreign policy. And by the way, it came from bad thinking. And that's why I think it's important for people who profess to think, I hope I think, you know, to write books, because when you start saying this is evil, that isn't, or this is genocide, that wasn't, this is ethnic cleansing, and this is not genocide, it's almost like you're splitting hairs.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's important that we do that.
Yeah.
I say in the book, how can you split hairs when butchers are splitting heads? Hmm. But you got to do that. You have to know what you're fighting.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of, you know, at least our listeners will easily recognize, you know, when I remember George H.W. Bush called, you know, Saddam Hussein, as he said, you know, compared him to Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I know I fell under temporarily the trance of Paul Berman's pen and his book Terror and Liberalism. I mean, it's a fantastically written and well-argued and, you know, I would say, you know, elegantly written, you know, extended essay, Terror and Liberalism. And he you know, puts out a very, you know, I think, cogent and elaborate argument about how, you know, contemporary Islamism is the new totalitarianism.
Yeah.
And it was seductive to embrace that, you know, is that kind of a little bit what you're responding to as well?
Yeah, although I find Berman, even when I felt closer to him, overwrought.
Yeah.
And never completely trusted his analysis because it just seemed, in Political Evil, I compare him to Whitaker Chambers, overwrought figure. The thinker that had the greatest impact on me, and I would describe it almost exactly the same terms used for Paul Berman, is, and this won't come as a surprise to you, Samantha Power.
Oh, yeah.
Because the first time I read her book, I was blown over.
Yeah.
I said, this is one of the most morally compelling, this book is so persuasive.
Mm-hmm.
And I taught it in classes and so on. So I've read it many times.
Yeah.
And then each time I read it, I find another problem and then another problem.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if there's anyone that, in my book, that I think I'm trying to address directly, it's Samantha Power.
Oh, interesting. So, I mean, let's just, you know, I'm curious now. I mean, if we can sort of operationalize, you know, the idea of political evil and what U.S. foreign policy should be, how would you differ with Samantha Power on the intervention in Libya?
You know, by all accounts, she's now in the Obama administration.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know what she does there, because no one does. You know, my guess is that she's still a liberal hawk, as we might say. By the way, Susan Rice is as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's interesting to me that with all this brouhaha going on about, you know, with McCain and Lindsey Graham attacking her, that her views are probably closer to theirs on substance than most Democrats.
Yeah, yeah.
And yet we're not having any national seminar on the views of Susan Rice. It's just an unfortunate feature of our politics.
Yeah.
I'm afraid I'm going to have to ask you to repeat your question.
Yeah, I'm just curious how you would, you know, so if this is kind of a reply to Samantha Power, how would you differ, maybe just not on particular policy, but overall policy about humanitarian intervention?
You know, I think, of course, I have absolutely no way of knowing whether anybody in the Obama administration read my book. I doubt it. But, you know, hopefully I'm writing about things that other people would see. And I think the way Obama has handled the problem I'm dealing with in the book, how do we respond to evil? He's doing pretty darn well.
Yeah.
You know, first of all, he doesn't use the term for rhetorical overkill the way the Bush and Cheney administration did.
Yeah.
But even on the concrete ones, Egypt and Libya, these are unbelievably difficult foreign policy puzzles.
Yeah.
And, you know, they make mistakes, probably, but the general approach strikes me as the only one that's workable. And the general approach in this case is avoid rhetorical overkill, make strong allies, and make sure your allies are with you. Seek relatively limited objectives. You know, the assassination of Osama bin Laden was not an attempt to eliminate terrorism, but to kill one man.
Yeah.
I think Obama made one disastrous decision, and that was to up the ante in Afghanistan. As I sort of describe in the book, you could talk about counterterrorism or counterinsurgency. And it's the same debate I'm addressing in a specific case. Do you try to stop an insurgency? In other words, do you try a political intervention in a country and take sides in the internal forces? Or should you have the more limited objective of just stopping terrorism?
Yeah.
And Obama went for the Petraeus, you know, send in a lot of troops and try to stop the insurgency. But he quickly realized, I think, that he made a mistake. Cleverly had Petraeus play a role in winding it down. So I would hope that whether through directly or indirectly, maybe some of the things I was trying to say in the book were absorbed in the Obama administration.
Yeah. I mean, to take us out of the grubby world of politics and back to the nuts and bolts of your book, one thing I think this is I'm paraphrasing, but you talk about to combat evil, we can't be so hard on ourselves. And I was wondering, you know, because I teach a comparative genocide class, and of course I've read James Waller, and he's somebody that you address. And I thought this was really one of the more interesting parts of your book. Do you want to talk about that?
Well, I'm glad you liked it.
Yeah.
I personally think it's the single most interesting thing in the book, but not that many people discuss it. I got really interested in St. Augustine. You know, Hannah Arendt, who wrote sort of the definitive book about evil with respect to the Eichmann trial, wrote her doctoral dissertation on Augustine. A lot of what Hannah Arendt was Augustinian in emphasis. And, you know, Augustine psychologized evil. Since God couldn't have created evil, as Augustine put it, he created human beings. And then in the Garden of Eden, he subjected us to temptation, and we failed the test. So he created us, and we created evil. And so religions that follow from a Calvinistic understanding, from an Augustinian understanding, especially Calvinist religions, you know, talk about our innate capacity for evil, and are very harsh on human beings, extremely harsh. It's a tough critique of ourselves. It's become very popular. Arendt wrote Eichmann in Jerusalem, and then Stanley Milgram was inspired by that to do the Milgram experiments, which shocked people. And, you know, a whole idea sort of developed that evil, we all have a capacity for evil. Evil is, you know, put us in the right situation, and we will all do it.
Yeah.
And I just never found that particularly compelling. The best single argument I know on behalf of it, in other words, on behalf of the position I disagree with, is a phenomenal little book by Nestorian Jan Gross called Neighbors,
yeah,
about how Poles committed acts of anti-Semitism. But even there was leadership and they were organized, and it wasn't just purely spontaneous.
Yeah,
I don't want us to be so hard on ourselves. I want us to celebrate people who resist evil. I want us to think that if we were in such a situation, maybe we would act with integrity, and maybe we would be courageous. I don't think that only saints do that. I think ordinary people can do that as well.
Hmm.
After the book came out, I wrote a long piece in the New Republic about the German theologian and pastor Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who resisted evil and paid a huge price for it. Other people do that as well.
Yeah, you know, I was trying to find a readable biography on Bonhoeffer to assign to my comparative genocide class, and the only thing I could really find were really some dense, you know, theological works. I couldn't, because
no, there's a guy Metaxas. The book I was reading, it's a very well written book.
Hmm.
It's come under a lot of criticism for people who say that the biographer is an evangelical, and people say he's trying to turn Bonhoeffer into an evangelical, but I found it a very compelling book.
Huh. And so, I mean, you spend a significant amount of time, I mean, you say you're an admirer of St. Augustine, but could you talk about your critique of sort of Augustine and our
understanding of evil? I said I was fascinated by it.
Fascinated, okay, yes.
Yeah. I'm not religious.
Yeah.
I just think... and I don't read the language he wrote in Latin, but the translations are often brilliant, and he writes about enormously fascinating things. And I can see why Hannah Arendt was so interested in him. After the book came out, while I was writing the book, the National Endowment for the Humanities had a little grant competition for people to teach courses on big themes, and I proposed teaching a course on the problem of evil. And they funded it. I think it was actually the first one they funded. And we were reading Arendt, and we were reading Joseph Conrad, and we were reading Shakespeare's Richard III, and Heart of Darkness, and Voltaire's Candide, Dostoevsky. It's a great, great course.
Wow.
So we're certainly reading Augustine as part of all of that.
Yeah. So what is your central contention or critique of his, view of evil?
I'm writing about political evil again.
Yeah, political evil.
In that sense, I sort of sidestep direct criticism by saying we need another concept, essentially, or we need a different set of questions. But, by and large, I do feel that he was given to a way of thinking in which, we look inside ourselves and we find the enemy inside ourselves. We have met the enemy, and he is us. And I'm just not persuaded by that. When I think now, I'm not a theologian, and I don't spend any time justifying the existence of God. So, in some ways, the problem of theodicy, the problem of how a good and all-knowing God could have put evil in the world, my answer was, well, if evil is in the world, then there's no God. But that's not obviously Augustine's.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One thing I find interesting is that you talk about how we actually have, since the Munich and Nazi analogy is so, what's the word? It existed in Stalinism. It existed in a very particular time in a very particular place, and that we just don't live in a world anymore that has that sort of political evil and sadism. And so I think
that level.
Yeah.
I think Rwanda was a genocide.
Yeah.
And we should have intervened.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't call it a genocide, and we didn't intervene.
Yeah.
I think Darfur was not a genocide, but we called it one. And I think we got to get it right. But it could happen again. I just don't. I think that I go through the book that, all the conditions that brought totalitarian into existence of the Great Depression, the horrors of World War One, because it was produced in the aftermath of World War One, the Great Inflation. I mean, the idea that any one of these could happen, let alone all six of them, however many are left, just strikes me as highly improbable.
Hmm. And so this is obviously topical, the Israeli Gaza conflict that just, well, hopefully concluded, and the Palestinian statehood bid. I mean, you have a chapter where you talk about, you know, the seductive attraction of ethnic cleansing. And, and if you just talk about your particular definition of ethnic cleansing and then sort of how that applies in the Israeli case.
Well, there is a theoretical distinction between genocide and ethnic cleansing.
Yeah.
In genocide, you're trying to eliminate a population you deem inferior. In ethnic cleansing, you're trying to remove a population from your land in order to preserve your land for your own particular ethnic group. You don't have to kill them for ethnic cleansing to take place, although often people do get killed. The reason why I wrote about ethnic cleansing is that, you know, I'm trying to show that the idea behind, I mean, the means are evil.
Yeah.
Forcible removal, all those killing, all those things. But the idea behind it of we're going to live in a nation roughly with composed of people just like ourselves is a very powerful and seductive one.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, was the removal of Native Americans in our past ethnic cleansing? It seems to me clearly it was.
Yeah.
And what about in 1948 when the State of Israel was created?
Yeah.
And there were an awful lot of Arabs, Palestinians, we now call them, living on land that Israel wanted. Palestinians call what happened the Nakba or the catastrophe.
Yeah.
Israelis prefer not to talk that much about it. And when they talk about it, say, oh, people just voluntarily left or whatever.
Hmm.
By any definition of ethnic cleansing, it seems to me that that's what's going on. That's what happened then. I also say, however, that some people, like the Israeli dissident Ilan Pappe, talk about what's happening now in Israel as ethnic cleansing, the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza and so on, and I don't. I think in Gaza we're dealing with war ethnic cleansing. And the occupation, the West Bank, whatever you want to call it, isn't so much requiring that people move, although that's a byproduct, but that's not its major intention. Its major intention is to expand the boundaries of the Israeli state. So it could lead to ethnic cleansing maybe in the future. There's also, one could imagine, a future in which Palestinians would engage in ethnic cleansing against Israelis.
Yeah.
But for my purposes, 1948 was an example of ethnic cleansing.
It's interesting. Those distinctions are so hard to make, but yet they're still important because of, you know, the entrenched, you know, the obviously entrenched positions on both sides.
Well, there's the American Jewish Committee sponsored the publication of a pamphlet about anti-Semitism among Jews. And one of the author's definitions is that if you call anything Israel has ever done ethnic cleansing, you're a Jewish anti-Semite. Well, by that definition, I'm a Jewish anti-Semite. I don't think of myself that way at all, but by that definition.
I've been to Israel many, many times, and it's an issue that I'm kind of passionately interested in.
Yeah.
And it just makes me so depressed when I hear it just makes sort of making meaningful distinctions and having substantive discussions just so seemingly impossible.
Yeah, it really is.
Back to the politics of counter evil. Could you talk about that for a few minutes? What it is?
Well, you know, as I say, it's when acts of political evil are committed against you or your country, you may be tempted to respond back in evil ways. You may be tempted to say, well, they had no constraints on their behavior, therefore we should respond that way. It's pretty obvious, however, and you know, don't take my word for it. CIA general leaders of the military can all tell you, and many did, that torture doesn't produce valuable information, that if we torture, we're just opening the doors for our own to be tortured. It was very, very important, I think, especially for this country, when confronted by something as horrific as 9/11, to say that we're not going to go down that road to what Dick Cheney called the dark side. But we did. I don't lay the blame at Bush's feet. I'm one of those people who thinks he was just in way over his head. For me, Cheney was the architect of our counter-evil policy, and the stain will always be on him.
And then your conclusion, if you just talk a little bit about, you know, what it means to get serious about political evil.
Well, yeah, you know, thanks for the question. I mean, and I guess we're wrapping up on this, but
yeah.
I go back to the late 1940s for a lot of the way that shaped the way I think.
Yeah.
And especially on the left.
Yeah.
Right after World War II, there was an attempt to say, oh, Joe Stalin isn't so bad, you know, or at least communism is trying to get the right goal and so on. And you got, in response to that kind of, I think, fuzzy-headed thinking, you got the development of a series of intellectuals who were very, very serious about the need for thinking about communism in a serious way. And they were George Orwell and Czesław Miłosz and Ignacio Solone and, I mean, a whole bunch of really, Arthur Koestler, Darkness at Noon, and a brilliant book. So when today we're confronted with genocide and ethnic cleansing, some of the thinkers in the sort of liberal hawk or hawkish tradition, like Paul Berman or Jean Beth Gelstein, they say, we're the ones who are really serious about evil, and we were the ones that follow in the footsteps of Orwell and Koestler. And I don't think that's true. I think they've gotten lazy about thinking about evil.
Yeah.
For me to get serious once again, to really follow in the footsteps of Orwell and Miloš and Koestler and these other great thinkers, is to start asking the questions rather than assume that we already have the answers. And so that's the theme of what's in the book.
Yeah, you're naming all the books on my recent book. I was reading this and I was like, oh yes, I just finished Ordinary Men, and I'm kind of an admirer of Jean Beth Gelstein because I see myself as. And there is a significant piece of the intellectual and some of the academic left that tries to operate in that tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that, you follow Berman or an Elstein, but at the same time, this is why I appreciate your book, is that you're trying to say, no, these people who claim that they're operating or speak for, the Orwell wing, have it wrong. I mean, so if you are largely sort of saying that Obama has generally gotten things right, and this is somebody who, whether he knows it or not, seems to reflect a better understanding of political evil. Maybe you could just, what sort of foreign policy, that if you were the new Samantha Power in the next administration, what kind of foreign policy would you, be pushing? I mean, is this just, kind of Niebuhrian in that you try to do what you can when you can? I mean,
some ways there's no doctrine, right? So there's the Bush doctrine, the Truman doctrine. There is probably no Obama doctrine, and there probably shouldn't be.
Yeah.
We shouldn't be using the word doctrine. We should be, I think, operating out of what, the great Boston College alum Tip O'Neill said, all politics is local. All political evil is local. We will have to be prepared when it happens. It will happen again. But let's avoid the big grand designs and the ideologies for a while. And take these things as they come, I guess. And so, that's really all one could say, I think. We've had enough grand designs.
Yeah, I think you're right. It seems that, I remember in the 90s, everyone was talking about where is the next Kennan? Where is the next new big grand strategy? And maybe that is the answer, that the worst thing that the Truman foreign policy bequeathed was the Truman Doctrine. It was everything before that that was really good.
anyway, thanks for this. This was really a terrific interview.
Our traditional question, and okay. I'm really fascinated now. What's next? What's your next project?
Oh, I am not going to write a book about Israel, but I am going to write a book about why the diaspora is good for the Jews.
Huh.
Why Jews flourish when they're in a minority, and why there's no necessary reason for all the Jews in the world to move to Israel. I don't view it as an anti-Israeli book at all, but just as broadening the debate over Israel.
Oh, interesting. Well, I'm going to go out and buy that one. So,
well,
yeah.
For a while.
Alan Wolf, thank you so much for your
thank
time.
Thank you, Jeff. This was a terrific discussion.
Okay. Have a good day.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Well, I hope you enjoyed my interview with Professor Wolf and our motivated to go out and buy his book, Political Evil. I will talk to you next week. Bye.